Thing. Mr. David Leroy Lewis, could you first tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in Sussex in a little village called Uckfield on the 14th of June 1918, a very long time ago now.
And who were your parents?
My parents were, my father was at that time in the army, but he came out very shortly afterwards. And my mother was nobody of importance.
And what did your father do? What was his profession?
He went into the discount market to start with, though I never did discover very much what he did then. He was invalided out of the army after a period of in Egypt in the 19 sort of 19 to 21 period, I think. And no, it must have been after that because my brother was born in 1921, and he was so it must have been 21, 23 sort of period. He was invalided out, and he went, then went into the discount market. And after that, he became managing director of the Imperial Continental Gas Association, of which my grandfather had been chairman,
Yes.
was probably chairman at that time.
So your father, your family had had a long-standing involvement in the city.
Yes, my grandfather, who was an American, no, naturalized English, did come into the city after he was educated, and we've had a city connect, a city experience ever since then, although neither of them had anything to do with the stock exchange.
Where did your father send you to school?
Sent me to school at Eton
Yes, and what years were
from
those?
1931 to 1936. I didn't go up to university after that. I was too young to go immediately in 1936, and I went. He sent me round to spend 6 months in Paris at the Sorbonne, and then I went travelling with a school friend through Belgium, Holland, Germany, Czechoslovakia. We got down to Budapest and then came back via Austria. But we did 4 months like that. I took the exam again for Oxford, got in, but decided that things were too dicey internationally. And that I wanted to get my feet on the a career ladder as soon as I could. That was like a decision that was really rather like the curate's egg. It was good in that I got into the city. I got took my articles. I was given articles with George A. Touche and Company, the predecessor firm of Touche Ross. And with whom my partners, the Touche family, I was the third generation of my family to be involved with them. And we will see that that involvement went on for the rest of my career on and off in various ways. But going back to the decision, I got my feet on the ladder. I got started my articles. The clock started ticking, and when I came back from the war, I found that the clock had run out. My articles were forgiven, and I had only to do a year's practical before I could take the final examination for the Chartered Accountants, and I was excused my inter. So from that point of view, the decision was good. What subsequently, much later in life, appeared to be the bad part of the decision was that I did miss the rather broader education that is given by the university. The mixing with people, the ideas that quite unconsciously get stimulated. And indeed, if I had gone to the university, I would have read law. And whether I would have, I think my career would bound to have been completely different.
Let's just go back a little bit. You said that the Touche connection was a family connection for three generations.
Yes, but they were the auditors of the Imperial Continental Gas, and had been for a long time. In addition, my grandfather knew and sat on an investment trust board with old Sir George Touche, the grandfather of Anthony. My father knew at least three of his four sons, of Grandfather Touche's four sons, and two were good friends of his. And so when I went there, I was the next generation. Mm. And Anthony Touche, who also became a partner in Touche Ross, mm. and one of the leading knights of Touche Remnant, is much younger than I am and came on afterwards.
Mm. Had you overlapped at school with any members of the family?
No.
No. And the were you with the services during the war?
Yes, I was with the anti-aircraft mm-hmm. all the time in this country.
Mm-hmm. And about when were you demobilised?
1946, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. And you decided to resume your career in accountancy?
It would have been silly not to have done. Yes. I mean, it's a very pertinent question, if I might say so, because the problems of after 5 years of picking up the academic training of one's mind to read a book and retain the salient knowledge in that particular chapter or chapters, I found extremely hard. But luckily, I found a little chap who had was earning his living by cramming private pupils after the war, and he had analysed the questions in the various papers, and so was able to focus one's mind on the salient principles that formed the basis for the different questions that occurred from year to year. But you must remember that at the time that I qualified, which was 1947, there was a great grave shortage of chartered accountants. They always said that the standard of results, the standard of the papers required for a pass, was never relaxed.
Did you also anticipate continuing the sort of city connections that your father and your grandfather had had?
Well, not precisely. Mm-hmm. There was no reason at all why I should have gone into Imperial Continental Gas at that time, which I suspect was recovering from the ravages of the war, because all their properties were, as you probably know, in Belgium. But yes, having qualified as an accountant, it never occurred to me that my career was going to take to lead me to anything else other than the city.
Was this one of the original reasons why you chose accountancy back before the war?
I think probably yes. I mean, if you think of it at that particular time, it was a profession, a professional qualification, was even in the 1936-37 a very desirable thing to have. And certainly as was the reason why I didn't go to the university, was the expectation that there was going to be a period of disturbance in the Western world. Obviously, a professional qualification was a better thing to have in those in such conditions than being, for instance, just a salesman, mm-hmm. or dare I say, just an academic. Mm-hmm.
Well, you returned to accountancy after the war.
Yes.
Can you describe what happened to you
then?
Yes.
Well, I had the problem of taking the final in a year, and to take the final for a year, I had to know all the academic side that was required for the intermediate examination. I was allowed to take the final from a year after I rejoined my firm. I believe that it was a requirement that I had to do 3 months practical, going out as a junior, auditing the accounts of firms within that year. Certainly that's what I did at the beginning. Mm. And then the firm was extremely kind and gave me a seat in an empty boardroom and allowed me to come in and do my study during the day. Mm. And then I went back at night and did the correspondence courses, which was starting up and the normal way to do the thing. Mm. It was, as I said, a fairly good nightmare in trying to retain that information. But fortunately, my mind responded, and I did, in fact, pass the first opportunity.
Mm. And you were then practicing as a qualified?
Then I did a few months as a qualified thing. But those were in the days when a chartered accountant firm had really nothing very much to offer except auditing. And I didn't really think that auditing was going to be the beginning and end of my working life. Mm. It was true that Touche's also had a side of the firm which was distinct from the chartered accountant's side, which dealt with the management of certain investment trusts. That stemmed from the days with old Sir George Touche, the grandfather, had converted a number of companies, particularly South American utilities, to British investment trusts. And my grandfather had done very much the same thing in one or two cases. And some of those investment trusts were managed, and there was one particular Touche partner, a member of the Touche family, who used to mastermind those. But that was very much a separate department of the firm, and the chartered accountant side of it had only to offer. It hadn't expanded, it hadn't diversified as the big firms have diversified and did diversify from the late 50s onwards. They only had auditing, and so I began to look for another job. I was offered a marvellous job with Shell, which was to be a member of a small, qualified chartered accountant team, which was objective of which was to put in order the and to consolidate the accounts of the subsidiary of the Royal Dutch Shell Group subsidiary companies from North Africa to Scandinavia. But unfortunately, that would meant being away from home from 9 months of the year. And I didn't feel that I could face that with a wife and a young family, and having been away as much as I had in the war, even though it was in this country. So I turned that down, and again I was offered a job to go in Canada, to go to Canada and join the Touche firm's associate company there. But again, I reluctantly turned that down because I couldn't envisage bringing up my children in Canada. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps it would be more truthful to say, envisage bringing up my children in other than England. Mm. There was nothing particularly wrong with Canada. Then I During the war, I had been in the Birmingham Anti-Aircraft Brigade headquarters with a person by name David Blackwell. David came to dinner with me and said, if I was looking for a job, what about becoming a jobber in the stock exchange and joining him? I gave this some thought, and the challenge of it was what appealed to me. It was totally unlike anything that I had done or anything that my family, any members of my family had done. There seemed that my training was not going to be wasted, because at least there would be the analysis of the companies in which one dealt to be done. And there were, and as it turned out, there were other things which were on which I drew from my knowledge that gained from theoretical knowledge gained from my training. And although my father said to me, why be a principal when you can make just as much money and do and live more peacefully as an agent, I didn't totally appreciate the depth of that observation at the time. Mm. I joined David Backwell's and became a partner there in after a short time as a blue button in 1948. Mm.
So you were about the age of 30 then?
So I was 30, yes. Mm. Mm.
Was that relatively old for people entering a stock exchange?
Well, it would
firm?
Have been if things were normal, but I suspect it wasn't relatively old for at that particular time because of the gap of 7 years of war. If there hadn't have been for that gap and that disturbance, I think people would have joined much earlier. Mm. Certainly as the 50s progressed, the age of the intake tended to drop. But I do remember that as I that the blue buttons at that particular time were people that I had known at school, although perhaps they did tend to be a little bit younger. Mm. Don't forget, many of them hadn't done, I think none of them had done a professional training as I had.
Now, could you say something about Blackwell & Co. at the time you joined?
Yes. It was what we would call now a small firm, dealing at that time just in the oil market. Mm. There was three partners of about my age, and one who was David Blackwell's father and who was very much older.
Mm. Had the father established the firm?
Yes.
Mm. And as you say, they jobbed primarily in they jobbed in the oil market?
Only in the oil market to start with. They did it subsequently, a few years after I joined them, three years maybe, expand into the Rhodesian copper market, because it was the same sort of flavour of market.
And about how big was the firm in terms of staff and office space and
small.
So on, but quite small?
Yes. Mm.
Do you have any particular memories about Mr. Blackwell's father?
My recollection of Father Blackwell as we knew him as was that he had a very simple pre-war, or what I regarded as pre-war, attitude towards the market. Mm. After the war, we began to, or David Blackwell began to develop the technique of taking short-term positions rather than just trading. Mm. a buy against a sale, or a sale against a buy. Father Blackwell, I think, never really fully appreciated this technique, which clearly was different to that that you would have adopted. He was the person, the partner, who kept the firm going during the war years, for instance, with some help from other people who weren't in the firm when I arrived.
And you said that the other partners were people of your own age.
Yes, they were.
Had they all returned from the war service themselves?
Yes.
And about how long did the older Mr. Blackwell stay with the firm before retiring?
Well, we merged with Ackroyd and Smithers in 1953, and I think that he must have retired perhaps 1 or 2 years earlier than that, but that is a date that I'm not very certain of.
Did you get any sense about how the firm had fared during the war?
No.
How it had adapted?
No. Don't forget that it was a partnership. And in those days, and I suspect it hasn't changed, or hadn't changed, it certainly hadn't changed by the time that I left the Stock Exchange. Partnerships, how a firm did, the profits of the firm, the capital of the partners and things, were very matters that were very confidential to the partners and were not shared with the staff. I'm sure that in the post-war period, immediate post-war period, the private ledger, which contained all those details, was very much a book that didn't come out of the locked safe very often.
Did you have a sense that you were starting fresh after the war?
It's difficult to remember. The partnership, the younger partners, had been in the firm before the war, and from that point of view, they weren't starting from afresh. I suspect, though, that if one had probed the situation, which one didn't, of course, but if one had probed the situation, perhaps they would have said, well, things are so different that we've had to start afresh. That's not quite the same as the question that you were putting to me. So far as I was personally concerned, yes, it was a totally strange world to me. It was a marketplace. It was in the old building. It was the oil market was quite often an open cry market. It was an area of the old building of the Stock Exchange which was entirely confined to the firms that dealt in oil shares. There was an open market in that one went and bid for shares and offered shares, which was part of a technique of trading in those shares. There were a lot of old people in that market immediately that had gone on throughout the war. Some of them were very old, and I remember one or two cases where there were casualties during the day from those old people. There was a tremendous feeling of comradeship, but competition, knife-edged competition. You wouldn't actually knife somebody, but you would do everything that you could to get the business in a way that was regarded as respectable.
About how many firms were jobbing in the oils market?
I would have thought that there was about 15 firms, small firms, in the oil market, but that's a recollection and probably not very accurate.
Let's return to you for a few moments. You started as a blue button.
Yes.
With the firm. Did you go through any particular form of training?
Well, my training was really standing on the pitches, observing what the partners did, observing the trading of that took place, trying to understand what it was all about, and being sent off to bid for stock from brokers' offices, and occasionally having to follow a particular broker who'd transacted business, who'd dealt, because it was not done for any of the partners to ask what firm he was in or what his name was. And this was before the days when everybody had to wear the badge of his particular firm, so that one wasted an awful lot of time in tracing people, trying to avoid them noticing that they were being followed, tracing them to their various offices and seeing and hoping that it was their office that they went into.
And where did you progress to after being a blue button?
Became a partner. Again, I think that was probably accelerated, and it was accelerated because of my professional qualification, and also because of the need that firms had for younger partners.
So you were given your own book?
Well, one was not given one's own book immediately, but one acted as a number two on a book, and prepared to stand in if the number one on the book went out for lunch or went out for an interview with a broker or whatever.
And about how long did you continue as a number two, as it were?
It was a small firm, and one didn't have the sort of set hierarchy that you had to have in the bigger firm. Because of it was largely brought about in the bigger firm by the need to have controls and to regulate the size of the books, etc., etc. So that in a small firm you didn't really have that, and I don't know how long it was.
Do you have any particular memories of this time?
No, I don't think I do. No, I think that the only memory that I have was that it was a very friendly place, the oil market. Whatever the age groups of the various people, and some were very much older, they were all extremely nice to one. And there was a lot of sort of good-natured joking that went on there.
Would you have said that about the stock exchange generally?
Yes.
At that time?
Yes.
Was there anything distinctive about the stock exchange then that has disappeared since? How would you characterise it as a place?
Well, I think it wasn't in terms of of the 50s or the 60s. It was really the watershed came, I think, when the building was torn down. The market is a living place, and it develops. It's a living both in the terms of the movements of the shares and the people who occupy it. The people who occupy it give the sort of atmosphere that you're, I think, referring to when you ask about changes. And if you are in the place the whole time, and you absorb those changes, and they take place without you really noticing them, because they take place gradually. But then something happens, like the move of the market from the old building, which was a very much an open floor with big pillars, to the new market, with its booths and things. It was totally different. And the atmosphere, there's no doubt that the atmosphere seemed to change. Whether it actually did change, or whether it was just that we, the participants in the market, had something to hang a change on, I'm not certain.
Did you have the sense, though, that the stock exchange wasn't an institution that had changed terribly much since the period between the wars, in terms of dress, in terms of the way the codes of behaviour that were observed?
Well, it's difficult for me to say that if you're talking about the period between the wars, that I wasn't actually there between the wars. One always heard that, yes, it did change, just as life changed between, if you look at the life in the first half of the 20s and life in the last half of the 30s, there was a tremendous change that took place overall. I'm sure that change must have been reflected in the stock exchange. I mean, the wearing of top hats still went on right through the 20s and 30s and didn't actually stop until later on. I was always told that brokers had to wear hats, top hats, because they were gentlemen.